From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, burglary is the original sin of the metropolis, and you can't tell the story of buildings without telling the story of people who want to break into them. So says Jeff Mano, the creator of Building Blog, a popular blog on architecture, who will join us to talk about his new book, A Burglar's Guide to the City. Then at 10:30, we meet Eric Ting, an Obie Award-winning director and the new head of Arinda-based California Shakespeare Theater. We'll talk with him about Cal Shake's upcoming season and about the Bard of Avon, who left this orb 400 years ago. Forum is ahead, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Burglary is a crime that can't occur without a building to break into, which means that many burglars are amateur experts in architecture. Whether it's learning a building's floor plan to escape via air duct, registering as a fake company to request a building's private blueprints, or tunneling into the side of a building by an alleyway dumpster, burglars can reveal vulnerabilities in human-made structures that most people never even notice. Jeff Mano, the creator of Building Blog, a popular blog on architecture, joins us this segment of Forum to talk about his new book, A Burglar's Guide to the City. And we'll find out what's revealed when we see a city through a burglar's eyes. Jeff, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, you say burglary is a unique spatial crime. It's an architecture crime, but it's also kind of difficult to define exactly what burglary is. And you have that inherent ambiguity in it. But burglary is built into the fabric of a city's architecture, you say.
It's true. And what's interesting about burglars is that their very profession, the being a burglar, is actually encoded in architecture. So without having a building, obviously, as you mentioned, you can't have burglars breaking into anything. And so in the very definition of the crime, you've got architecture kind of at its heart. And so I really wanted to explore that notion that kind of in the very DNA of the architectural environment, in the very core of the city, you've got burglars and the buildings that they're breaking into legally entwined.
And there's also a sense of what we talk of as burglary as being almost a kind of dying breed of old-fashioned crime. I mean, with computers and hacking and essentially the kind of cyber stuff that's going on. In fact, the Wall Street Journal, I think, talked about burglary, and your book is dying art.
Yeah, it's funny, actually. So burglary is plunging in terms of its statistical likelihood. So in New York City, where I live, it's actually down 87% since 1990, which in a generation, you know, is makes that enough of a plummet that it's nearly an endangered crime. It's quite funny, actually. One of the burglars who was one of the most interesting ones who I spoke to while writing the book is based in Toronto. And he claims to be a former burglar, but he actually spoke with, I'd say, pretty tangible melancholy about his position as kind of the last real burglar, in at least as he saw it, in the Toronto metro area.
Was this the guy who memorized the fire codes?
It was the guy who memorized the fire code. Yeah, he had a real brain for this and was really into the details. And, you know, treated it really like a, not just an art, but really like a science, you know, by memorizing the fire code and studying the very code of Toronto. He was able to use that to help target the next building that he would choose.
That's so fascinating, you know, how smart some of these guys are and wily and cunning and all the rest of it. And you think if they hadn't gone to the transgressive side of things, who knows what they could have done with all that gray matter. And because they have to figure out architecture in a way sometimes, I mean, in the examples you use, and you take us back to antiquity, that shows incredible kind of smarts. There's also, you know, almost a fascination that you have with burglars. So somebody would read your work and think, what's with this guy? Why is he so interested in burglars? But you're also rather harsh about them. You say they're like mosquitoes. They take people's valuables. There's nothing romantic about it, even though we've romanticized it to a great degree in so many movies.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to, and justified, actually, to look at their technical ingenuity and the innovations that a burglar might come up with, you know, such as studying fire code or using architectural skills to build duplicates to then study before breaking into the actual building that they're approaching. You know, that really does take a level of creativity and a kind of lateral thinking that I do think is actually pretty admirable. But on the other hand, obviously, burglary does entail a lot of not just financial, but emotional violation. You know, when you have someone entering a place that you consider secure, that you consider your own home, and they come in and steal not just objects, but also your sense of security. And, you know, often will violate even your ability to trust your neighbors, even family members that might have known you were away on vacation. You know, it's a really invasive crime. And I think that you can't forget that whilst being hypnotized by this image of, you know, the George Clooney or the Cary Grant-like cat burglar sort of scampering through the imagination of Hollywood. I think it's really important to remember that burglary does have a pretty significant human cost.
Talk about, since we're talking about that human cost and the vulnerability that people have, some of the things you've learned that people can apply, well, to homes, apartments, to businesses and so forth, to really protect them from the vulnerabilities. I mean, architecturally, you talk about some of this in the book and maybe right off the top of your head in terms of the most important kinds of things.
Well, there's little things, and that's the good news about preventing or at least helping prevent burglary, is that it's actually just sort of common sense decisions that you want to give a burglar just a few seconds of hesitation so that they don't choose your place. And so it can be everything from, you know, a lot of people rely on, you know, hedges or privacy fences to shelter them when they're eating breakfast and don't want to be seen by their neighbors. But that's exactly the same thing that a burglar can hide behind so that no one will see if they're in the house. Double or triple pane storm glass is not just good for your energy bills, but is also good for keeping burglars from wanting to shatter the windows and crawl through because there's that much more glass. You can even look at things like, you know, pet doors or branches of trees that go up easily to the second floor of your home or business, because those are other entryways that are surprisingly often taken advantage of.
Single pane windows also are not necessarily as advisable as getting double paned or getting better windows than that.
Yeah, single pane would be not just energy inefficient, but is also so much easier to break through. Or even in one pretty ominous case that I mentioned in the book, there was a gentleman that actually worked for a glass replacement company, and he decided that he would use those skills to break into people's houses so he could actually literally cut the window pane out, go into the house, come back out through the window, and then reaffix the window pane so that the homeowners would come home and not even necessarily notice that someone had come in. But so you can't do that kind of thing if you've got double or triple pane windows.
What do you make out of these, I call them burglars because that's what they are. We had a rash of these kind of thefts here in San Francisco. There'd be jewelry stores and they just break the glass. I don't know what kind of glass it was. Maybe it just wasn't strong. But, you know, as you point out in your book, if there are doors, they can be broken into. If there's glass, it can be broken into. But just that kind of burglary where you just smash the glass and take the goodies. Mm.
Well, there's actually a term for that. It's called a smash and grab.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those are definitely lower on the list of architectural interest in terms of discussing how a burglar might case a joint or choose a building for its structural or other spatial vulnerabilities. But yeah, those kinds of things are not only very common, but, you know, those are crimes of opportunity. You know, you see a jewelry case and you basically you smash it and grab and run.
You say a burglar is a three-dimensional actor amid the two-dimensional services and objects of the city.
I do. Yeah, I think that comes out of the realization that what I think is interesting about burglary is that in many ways, burglars don't take architecture for granted. I think that it's quite easy as a civilian, speaking for myself, to really kind of go with what the architect laid out for me. So I'll go through the door that is there. I will walk down the hallway that has been designed for that purpose. I will trust that floors and ceilings are there to separate me from the levels above and below. But a burglar comes into that and treats it really kind of more like an immersive three-dimensional puzzle. They think, how can I get from this room to the next? How can I get from this floor to the next? And suddenly now you enter into this whole new vocabulary of architectural movement where you've got them cutting holes through drywall to get from one room to the next, or sawing up through the ceiling to get into the room above, or of course the quite common route into businesses is down through the roof. So get up onto the roof, do a roof job and cut down and enter. And so what's really interesting about that for me is that, you know, it reveals, in fact, that there are all these alternative ways of moving through the city and of exploring architecture, and that if you divorce burglary from its emotional stakes that we talked about earlier, there's actually some very interesting spatial ingenuity involved. And I think that it really kind of reveals something about the potential of the urban environment as something that we, too, could think about differently in terms of how A is connected to B.
Yeah, you're talking about rooftops. Makes me think about that McDonald's burglary you write about that was moving on rooftops. But again, you know, there was a lot of planning that went into that, as there is in so many burglaries, watching, staking out, and so forth and so on. And now, I think with this, I guess what you call it, basically a giant data gold mines, Google Street Views and websites that simply provide all the data on buildings that you could want, makes it a lot easier for burglars, doesn't it?
It does, and it's pretty worrying, actually, when you realize the amount of information that is out there about your own home or business. And so you may have noticed this perhaps yourself if you've ever Googled a friend's address, if they're inviting you over for a dinner party or that kind of thing, and one of the first or even the first three or four, actually, hits that come back on Google will not just be the map to their place, but will be Zillow or the real estate agency that might have marketed their home or apartment, or even the developer's website. And if you click on these, you can find floor plans. You can even find stage internal photographs that were put together by the marketing team before the building went for sale. And from those bits of information, you can gather quite a lot of detail about what it is that you might, or that someone, rather, might be breaking into. So they can look at everything from the make of the locks that are on the front door to the position of fire escapes to the windows themselves and how they lock, let alone the floor plans, so that you can know immediately how to get into the, say, the garage and then up the stairs to the master bedroom. So those kinds of information are out there. They're very convenient for real estate shoppers, but they also do present a pretty obvious security risk.
Talking to Jeff Mano, and he's the author of Building Blog. That's an architecture and design blog that was launched back in 2004. He's also a former senior editor of Dwell Magazine and has taught graduate design courses at Columbia and USC. And his most recent book is A Burglar's Guide to the City. And I should mention that he has published in the New York Times and the New Yorker and Atlantic and Popular Science and a whole range of different magazines. And you can join the conversation. If you have questions, thoughts, comments, we want to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. And if you do have questions or comments, now would be the time to call. This is a half-hour segment. We're going to shift gears after the half hour in the bottom part of the hour. So feel free to join us. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. I'm sure there are many people who may want some tips on how to make your place of your home, your business less vulnerable, and also just talk about architecture and its connection to burglary, because that's really what we're talking about here. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Lots of things in the mix here, and I think also it should be pointed out that from your point of view, technology has actually made cities, because we're talking about cities often when we're talking about your work, more vulnerable to crime.
It has, and it's been through pretty interesting means, actually. You see a lot of hype and optimism around the so-called smart city of the future, or the networked city with its infrastructure all woven together through digital code and sort of centralized databases where you can control traffic or the sewage infrastructure, or for that matter, the streetlights, through just you know, the tap of a few keys. But what's really interesting, of course, is that if the wrong people get access to those same systems, you get into a totally different breed of crime. And so, in fact, you're seeing a lot of evidence now, and people presenting at security conferences, that they have found ways to hack into streetlights, traffic lights, even to redirect traffic using smartphone apps and that kind of thing. And so what's interesting about that is not only just that that presents itself a kind of urban scale vandalism, but also that you can use those kinds of things for other crimes. So in the book, for example, I talk about engineering the perfect getaway route, which would be possible through controlling the streetlights, almost like something from The Italian Job, or through smartphone apps that would redirect police and other cars from certain routes because they believe that there's a traffic jam there. And so there's a lot of vulnerabilities kind of hiding in plain sight that are being overlooked in the enthusiasm for creating the technologically immersive city.
Also, you point out that a lot of these current fail-safe methods that are designed to protect cities from, for example, power outages, actually leave them more vulnerable.
It's true. And I think that that's really, you know, the other, you know, you mentioned earlier the fire code example. I think it's really kind of one of the ironies of security research, in fact, that, you know, one side will come up with something that is about keeping people safe. So they'll come up with, say, the fire code, which will regularize the way that architecture is built in a city. It will protect people from fire. It will give you a, make sure that you have an escape route. But if the wrong person comes along and has that information, as this burglar in Toronto did, he can then use that fire code to choose his next, the next thing he wants to break into. And it's the same with these kind of fail-safe systems, that they're designed for the protection of the public, but of course, they can be taken advantage of from the other side.
Well, let me bring a caller on here. And Saul, you're our first caller. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Not sure if you know San Francisco specific regulations, but here's my conundrum, is that I live in an apartment building and my landlord will not make the intercom system work, so everybody in the building just leaves the front door unlocked when they're expecting guests. So that's obviously a huge vulnerability. So I'm curious if there's any liability or responsibility on the shoulders of my landlord to secure our building. And I'll,
I don't know if Jeff is a lawyer here in terms of liability, but yeah. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I definitely can't comment on that from a legal point of view. So by no means would this be legal advice. But yeah, that does sound that if something were to happen in your building and it's because the front door has been left unlocked and your landlord won't fix the intercom, that sounds like an interesting case of liability to me. But again, I can't comment on that, not being familiar with San Francisco regulation or being a lawyer. But it is something that I would be concerned about if...
Here's a comment from a listener named Robert who says, anyone who wants to case a home such as those featured at Zillow need only attend an open house or schedule a viewing at the residence.
That's true as well. Yeah, there's many ways into to seeing an interior or an exterior, and that's yet another one. Yeah, you can easily just attend an open house. You can even schedule a tour with a real estate agent and get the lowdown on an entire neighborhood and learn everything about it in terms of even local police stations, the regularity of police patrols and that kind of thing. And yeah.
And you mentioned the films that, well, to some extent, maybe romanticized Thomas Crown Affair, that sort of thing, burglary of sorts. And there's a lot in your book about Die Hard, which I think a lot of people think of as the ultimate sort of thriller movie in many ways. But it's also a movie that where you see things through the eyes of the architecture and how it affects. Here's a listener who says, I'm a huge fan of heist movies. What does your guest think about movies like Ocean's 11 series? What do they get right and what do they exaggerate?
Well, I think they pretty much exaggerate everything, to be honest, but I think that that's part of the fun of that genre, as well as that series, is that it really takes things up, it turns it up to 11, so to speak, and I think that's part of the joy. But what really is interesting about those movies is that they do kind of exist in a feedback loop with existing burglary techniques, and so you do see where something might be presented in a heist flick that is pretty unbelievable, but then you'll find that it has inspired someone to actually undertake that kind of crime in real life.
Copycat and, comes aboard. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
Let me bring another caller aboard, and that's you. Howard, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I just wanted to use this opportunity to point out that when people post on their Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn that they're going on vacation, there are bots out there and systems out there that scrape all that information. And I think one of them might have been called robmyhouse.com, which gives you this beautiful interactive Google mashup map that shows you who's not home and who's vulnerable. So just a heads up.
Yeah, good heads up, and thank you for that, Howard. Some thoughts from you, Jeff Maynard?
I mentioned one of those apps in the book. It was called pleaserobme.com, and it was exactly that, where it would take location information from social media. And, what was really funny was that the people who ran the bot or the service, quote unquote, you know, went out of their way to say that it wasn't an attempt to actually get people robbed. It was simply to point out that oversharing on social media can have real consequences. But
they were just trying to help people.
Yeah. But there are cases even in the book, too, where people deliberately use Facebook, becoming friends with people and then inviting them out to meet, you know, on a first date or that kind of thing. And then while the person goes out to meet the stranger, they actually then go and break into their house. So it's a world of paranoia if you fall into it.
Well, it's also I mean, for example, if you go to a place and you have your car parked, you should take the car key off and not necessarily have your house keys on there. Pointed that out to a friend of mine recently who said, you're being paranoid. No, you're not being paranoid. You're just being prophylactic. A listener writes, are there common features of modern office buildings or corporate office parks that are actually a result of architects and building owners trying to fend off burglaries?
There are, actually. You do see a lot of things being integrated into architectural design. Unfortunately, a lot of this actually comes after market. So in other words, architects kind of see their job ending at a certain point and then will throw it off to private companies that will come in later and then fortify the building. So an architect can get away with pretty much designing anything they want, knowing that then someone has to come in and kind of fix the vulnerabilities and blind spots. But you do see aspects that get incorporated, especially into bank design and that kind of things, where you have clear lines of sight for people entering and exiting the bank facility. You see choke points that have been designed into not just some banks, but also into casinos and other large institutions where you funnel crowds through tighter areas where you know that that will have to be their means of exit if it's a criminal, but also where you can take photographs of people so that you can actually get people on CCTV. So a lot of times actually the internal circulation of a building is in fact arranged for the visual purposes of a security team so that you are meandering down those halls, not just to get from one point to another, but so that you can have your photograph taken. So little things like that are being built into the everyday environment that are security measures and are actually quite interesting to think about.
Couple of interesting things to think about from listener questions here. Lucas wants to know, could you comment on the relationship between burglary and urban exploring?
I could actually, yeah. I think it's a quite interesting moral question in that, urban explorers think of themselves as anything but burglars. They have a pretty justifiable and interesting position, which is that infrastructure is by default public space and that there should be a public right to explore it. There should be right of access, right of photography, even right of cartography for that matter, to point out where these systems are and what they are like to spatially experience them. And so, you know, in the book, I had originally intended on writing about urban exploration kind of in the context of burglary. But of course, you can imagine, if you walk into a room full of urban explorers and start saying that you are writing this book about breaking and entering, there's not much enthusiasm. It's in the book, I compare a similar case to actually, going out to the suburbs and finding heavy metal fans and then asking them what it feels like to be a Satanist. It's a pretty dubious point of view from an interview, and it's not the best way forward.
Another listener asks, is the use of putting many locks on an apartment door really a deterrent or just a false comfort for a future victim?
No, it would be a deterrent. I mean, if you've got enough that someone... Because what you're really trying to do is add time. You know, I often say that
write about how easy locks are to pick.
Yeah, but if you add a lock to a door, you're basically adding a clock to a door. So you're saying that this will take you another 10 or 15 seconds. And so if you have multiple locks, that can be enough to prevent someone to choose another apartment. But having said that, one, they can pick those locks. Two, they can probably kick through those locks. And then three, if your walls aren't secure and if you have something in that apartment that they truly want, they'll come in through the wall.
I'm also amazed recently at seeing how easy safes are to open, though people feel that their valuables are really safe. And we got a lot of questions here, but we're hearing the music coming up, and it means we're flat out of time. But it's really been enlightening, and thank you for joining us, Jeff Maino.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was a fun conversation.
Building Block, an architecture and design blog that was launched in 2004 by Jeff Maino, and he is also the author of A Burglar's Guide to the City. And in the segment up ahead, we're going to meet Eric Ting, who's the new head of Cal Shakes. That's California Shakespeare Theater. And we're going to talk about Shakespeare 400 years after his death. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.